Welcome to Green and Red, scrappy politics for scrappy people, a regular podcast on radical environmental and anti-capitalist politics, brought to you by Bob Bazanko and Scott Park.
Welcome to the Silky Smooth Sounds of the Green and Red podcast. I'm your co-host, Scott Park, in Berkeley, California. And as always, I am joined by
Bob Bazanko in Houston.
Yep. And today we're very excited to be talking with Yiannis Varoufakis, who is an economist, a political leader, the author of numerous best-selling books. He's the former finance minister of Greece. And he has a new book out, which we're going to be talking about today, which is called Techno-Feudalism, What Killed Capitalism. Welcome to the Green and Red podcast, Yiannis.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Scott, Bob. It's a pleasure to be in your company.
Thanks.
Just to kind of kick off with the book is that you have a very provocative thesis about tech feudalism killing capitalism. And so maybe we can just start off with the question is, why is capitalism dead? What has led to this monumental transition?
A new form of capital has risen up, has evolved. In the same way that some viruses produce variants, this is the language that we have been headed in now from the pandemic, but just like viruses can produce variants that are extremely potent and toxic, so much so that typically they kill off the host that they rely on in order to survive themselves. This is my hypothesis. My hypothesis is that capital has been so triumphant. It has steamrolled over all opposition from organized labor, from social democratic or democratic governments, the Green Movement. Capital, wherever we look, we see its triumph. But this triumph, combined with the great financial collapse of 2008, which spearheaded the printing of rivers of money by our central banks, my estimations are around $35 trillion has been printed between April 2009 and last year, only in the G7. This amount of money, which was combined with harsh austerity for the masses out there, the United States, in Europe, in Britain, in my country, of course, we were the champions of austerity. This combination of austerity for the many brings down demand for goods and services, and huge liquidity for financiers meant that capitalists didn't invest, except those who invested in this new toxic form of capital, which I call cloud capital. Now, if my hypothesis is right, and this is my hypothesis, that cloud capital is a very novel form of capital. It's nothing like the capital we were used to. Capital so far has been a produced means of production, like a fishing rod or a tractor or an industrial robot, something you build to produce something else, a produced means of production. What lives in here? In our cell towers, on optic fiber cables, in server farms and so on, this algorithmic capital, I call it cloud capital because supposedly it's in the cloud. Of course, it's not in the cloud, it's right down on Earth, except some satellites. This cloud capital is a produced means of modifying our behavior, of behavioral modification. And the owners of that cloud capital are not simply capable of extracting surplus value from wage labor, but they can create platforms like Amazon, like Alibaba, like Uber, like Airbnb. I call them cloud thieves. They are made of cloud capital. They live inside the internet and digital technology, but they are like thieves in the sense that inside of them, they manage to magnetize users, you and me, but also vassal capitalists, capitalists who produce stuff like, anyone who produces an app that they sell through the App Store, or anyone who produces an electric bicycle that they sell through Amazon.com, 30-40% of the price goes to the owner of this cloud fiefdom. That's no longer capitalism. So, and here's my conclusion to this very long initial answer. My hypothesis is that cloud capital has replaced markets with cloud thieves. And therefore, in the process, it has shrunk severely the role of profits in this realm of ours. And it has expanded the role of rents, which are cloud rents. They are not ground rents, in the sense that you don't pay for the landlord anymore, as it used to happen under feudalism, but you pay cloud rent to Bezos and Zuckerberg and Apple and Google and so on for access to the cloud thief that has replaced markets. And that, to me, is not capitalism anymore. And I have to admit that it took me a long time to drum up the courage to come up with the outrageous hypothesis that capitalism is already dead. But I do believe it, and that's why I wrote the book. Otherwise, I wouldn't have written it.
So you're suggesting capitalism is dead, but you also, at various points in the book, you know, kind of talk about the continuing power of it. You know, where they run parliaments and the IMF and the World Bank and the military industrial complex. So is this kind of a transition from one group to another? I mean, what does it actually mean to say capitalism is dead? I mean, we're still. Oh, go ahead.
I mean, you're a historian, so you know this better than me. That when we made the transition from feudalism to capitalism, our governments didn't go away, our armies didn't go away. You know, the British Army, from supporting the king and the lordly establishment, the feudal realm, switched sides and started supporting the accumulation of capital through the British Empire. So, you know, when you go from one socioeconomic mode to another, you don't lose all the institutions. What happens is the institutions adapt. And we already have seen the institutions adapt in your country, in particular, in the United States. You know, in the penultimate chapter, I asked myself the question, which I think everybody should ask, maybe not come up with the same answer, but we should ask, why is the United States, under both Donald Trump and Joe Biden, pursuing a Cold War against China? And I don't want the answer about Taiwan, because I lose the will to live. I've grown up in a world where the U.S. policy was one China policy over Taiwan. And it was very clear when Nixon went to Beijing that China considered Taiwan to be an integral part of China. So that's not new. can't be the reason, Taiwan. And it can't be the reason that, you know, that there is espionage by the Chinese and the Americans. My goodness, you know, I mean, a country that has the NSA talking about espionage. So there's something else is happening. And my view is that in the same way that the British state, the British bureaucracy, the British Army and Navy, the Royal Navy, transformed its role and started new kinds of projection of power. Once Britain switched from being feudal to being capitalist, something similar is happening here. And just to end my sojourn into the new Cold War, what is happening with the new Cold War is that, you know, the United States and China are the only countries that own substantial amounts of cloud capital. And therefore, there is this clash, rivalry between two super cloud fiefdoms, as I call them.
So are you basically, you're saying that do you think production is kind of the key to capitalism, that you're producing and manufacturing goods for sale in a marketplace? And the cloud itself isn't really doing that, right? It's collecting information. It's surveilling us. It's, in fact, as you point out, like creating our needs for us in a way that modern advertising used to do. So is production kind of the key to this transition, the fact that these cloudless aren't really producing, you know, commodities?
Yeah, I mean, this is commodities. This is one way of putting it. There's no doubt that what you're saying is consistent with my story. But I would slightly differently, because I think we need to pinpoint the precise shift, the precise change. Production has been important in every society. You know, from the moment we started thinking of ourselves as humans to this day, production has been at the very foundation of our capacity to reproduce our lives. So this is central today, it is central under capitalism, feudalism, slave-owning societies, and so on and so forth. The fundamental shift concerns power. Where is power coming from? Under the feudal circumstances, under feudalism, it came from owning the land. If you own the land, you had the power to make people do things on your behalf, like peasants growing food, and you send the sheriff in, you collected your share if you were the landlord. And that share allowed you to capitalize it then, to financialize it, to have armies, to have influence over the state, the king, and so on. Under capitalism, even though landowners still had power, that never went away. Real estate markets. I mean, think in the United States, how important the real estate market is, or in China, for that matter. But nevertheless, if you really were to explain to extraterrestrials what is special about capitalism, you'd say that what is special is capital, that is machinery, produce means of production. So real power came no longer from owning the land, but from owning the produced means of production. And what I'm now saying is that real power comes from owning these produced means of behavior modification. The capitalist sector is embedded in what I call techno-feudalism. It's essential. In the same way that the agricultural sector, the feudal sector, especially, you know, think of the South in the United States during the 19th century, even today. You know, without food production, there can be no capitalism. Without the feudal sector, there can be no capitalism. But the feudal sector under capitalism was no longer dominant. Similarly, the capitalist sector, you know, factories producing batteries, factories producing, you know, the actual machine, this phone, or a car, they are still essential to what I call techno-feudalism. But ownership of this old-fashioned kind of capital, of terrestrial capital, is no longer what gives you power. What gives you power is ownership of the cloud capital that has capacity to modify behavior, to create the cloud thieves, and therefore to empower you with extractive power, rent extractive power, a new form of, you know, all singing or dancing, advanced form of rent. That's my story.
In the book, you talk about how 2008 was a sort of pivotal moment in this because the central banks put a lot of money in. But then you also talk about how 2020 is another pivotal moment, particularly for Bezos and Elon Musk, at the advent of the pandemic. And I'm wondering if you could just actually go into that a little bit.
Yes, 2008 was a pivotal moment worldwide. When it was happening, I don't know how you felt, but I felt it in my bones that was our generation's 1929. That nothing would make sense again in the terms that we used prior to 2008, just exactly in the same way that nothing made sense in the United States after 1929 in terms of the conventional logic of the early 1920s or the mid-1920s. To push my case a little bit harder, I felt, and I've been feeling increasingly so, that 2008 was to capitalism, that which 1991 was to communism. The moment of its, a catastrophic crisis, a crisis from which it could never recover. Now, of course, financial markets recovered within a year and a half in the United States and in Europe. Not so much in Europe. Europe took much longer. But, you know, even the trade deficit of the United States bounced back. And you continue to operate as a massive vacuum cleaner, sucking into the United States the net exports of everybody else. But the United States economy never recovered the role that it had before 2008. The way I understand it is this. You had a period of Bretton Woods between 1944 and the mid-1970s. 1971 to 1975 was the death knell of the Bretton Woods system. That was a kind of planned international capitalist economy and planned by Washington. It was a dollar zone. We had fixed exchange rates. Effectively, we had the same currency. We all had the dollar with capital controls, right? And the only way you can sustain such a fixed exchange rate regime is if the hegemon, the United States, has a surplus. Because if it has a surplus and it produces the world's currency, the dollar, then, you know, with every washing machine or car or aircraft that it sells to Europeans or to the Japanese, it takes back the dollars it has produced for them. So there's a nice, neat recycling mechanism happening.
The dollar gap after World War II, right?
Yeah, but it was designed. It was part of the Bretton Woods system, right? That's what made the Bretton Woods system such a very interesting design and why it worked so well for at least 15 years. But then once the United States slipped from a surplus position to a deficit position, this was gone. It was inevitable it would crash and burn. And then you had the second period after the early 1970s, up until 2008, where you had the reverse recycling mechanism. The United States went deeper and deeper into the red when it came to the trade surplus, and that was intentional. This was part of the new design. And as I said before, it was like a vacuum cleaner, the United States sucking into its territory the net exports of Germany, of Japan, and later China, along with the Saudis and so on. And how was it paying for that? Well, it was also sucking into Wall Street 70% of their profits. And on the back of this huge tsunami of money that was coming in Wall Street from outside the United States, the financiers built their derivatives. They started playing games with them, which is what, you know, if you give $1 billion every 5 minutes to a financier, they find ways of making it grow through financialization. That's financialization, neoliberalism for me. These are all repercussions of this inverse or inverted recycling mechanism, right? Now, because they built so much private money through in the form of bets, wages, on the back of this tsunami of capital going to Wall Street, when it collapsed in 2008, even though the governments came in and replaced the private money that had burned down with state money, with Fed money, with European Central Bank money, with Bank of England money, and so on, because they were practicing austerity at the same time, and therefore depressing investment demand and so on, the recycling capacity of the system, which had been severed by the 2008 crisis, simply couldn't work anymore. This is why since 2008, we've never managed to recover. This is what, for me, if you really push me, I would even say that Donald Trump is a result of that. The rise of neo-fascism, of xenophobia, the collapse of the social democracy, the death of the liberal individual. All those things have to do with the way in which the global recycling mechanism that was built on the American deficits, even though the American deficits bounced back, that system never worked again. And it relied enormously on China to generate the lost demand and on bubbles and on printed money, which funded the creation of the cloud capital, which then, together with the privatization of the internet, of the original commons, internet commons, which then became privatized through big tech, Silicon Valley, but also the Chinese version in the eastern coast of China, you have this replacement, this is my theory, of globalized capitalism by a clash of two different techno-feudalisms, one American and one Chinese. And the rest of the world is utterly irrelevant. Europe has become irrelevant as a result of this because we spent 20 years practicing austerity and having zero investment in cloud capital. This is why Europe now is not even interesting to discuss. And we have become vassals of NATO, and we don't even have a voice about what is happening in Ukraine and so on. So anyway, this is my overarching story.
When you say that the cloudless have capital, do you mean capital power, I'm sorry, over us as consumers by determining our needs and having algorithms to tell us what to look for and everything like that? And do they also have power over banks and parliaments and governments? I mean, how expansive is it?
They have power over everyone.
Over everything.
They are the new ruling class.
So we've kind of lived in an era of financial capitalism, and you know, Vanguard and BlackRock and State Street are mega trillions in business every year. So how are
I wouldn't count State Street and Vanguard and BlackRock as financiers. They're rentiers. They are essentially, they are like that, intermeshed with cloud capital. Wall Street's role is diminishing. if you look at this agglomeration of cloud capital and private equity, and I do write in my book about private equity quite extensively, because they are the ones also who are extracting rents. So they are rentiers. Mm-hmm. Of course, the bankers were always rentiers, except that the capacity of Wall Street now to accumulate rents is, in proportional terms, shrinking in relation to Silicon Valley, big tech, to cloud capital, and the private equity business. If you now look at the way in which the portfolio of BlackRock is evolving, if you look at, you know, Vanguard, you know, what do they own? What they do is they try to buy the whole of the New York Stock Exchange. Effectively, they own the New York Stock Exchange. They own or control up to 80-90% of the companies that are listed in there. But what is it made of? The Magnificent Seven, the Mag Seven. And what are these? These are the cloudalists. So that's why I'm saying that there is a symbiotic relationship between private equity and cloud capital, with the role of the state, of traditional capitalists, of you and me, of labor unions, including the federal government, shrinking into insignificance compared to the power of this new ruling class.
I guess my next question is going to deviate from this a little bit, is that we're both fans of Mad Men, and really appreciate you using Mad Men as an example to describe, you know, this transition that's happened. And so you described Don Draper and Peggy in, you know, the I guess it's an episode where they're like, you know, figuring out how to make people, like, using Hershey's, how, you know, a Hershey bar is going to be more, they're going to have a more significant relationship with a Hershey bar than with other people, based on, like, nostalgia and things like that. And then you talk a lot about the sort of, like, behavior modification that we're seeing with the cloudalists, and with, I think a good example is just, like, Alexa is, like, you know, tracking what you buy and what you say and what you listen to and what you read and all of that sort of stuff, and then using that to sell to you, and even, like, kind of changing our behavior. I'm wondering if you could actually talk a little bit about the difference between Don Draper and that sort of advertising period of Madison Avenue in the 60s and 70s, and then, like, today with Alexa and Siri, and how that is working.
Well, Mad Men and women, Don and Peggy. Had to rely on being brilliant. And they had to rely on being brilliant at, you know, harvesting our nostalgia and therefore grabbing our attention and inputting desires into our hearts and minds for commodities, because they relied on one-way street processes. So, you know, even the most brilliant ad that you come up with on a poster or a television ad, or radio ad, whatever, magazine, it was one way. It came from the medium into our senses. That's it. Finished. If it worked, you know, then we craved a burger or a chocolate bar. And then we had to go to the shop and buy it. End of story. That's it. They were a service sector to the monopoly capitalists, Don and Peggy. But if you compare it to Siri or to Google Galaxy or Assistant or Alexa and so on, or indeed Spotify, and Netflix, and the algorithms that are in there, this is not a one-way street anymore. It's a fully dialectical, infinite two-way process. So this thing here constantly trains me to train it, to train me to train it, to train me to train it, to train me to train it, to know me better. It's never ending. It's 24 hours a day, even in my sleep. It is being trained. Even when, you know, it notices how many times do I get up to go to the loo, right? So it has information about me that cumulatively creates a qualitative capacity to impress me, not with the smartness of its, you know, advertising, but with great, fantastic suggestions. I don't know about you, but, you know, Spotify, whenever Spotify recommends music to me, I like it. Sometimes I love it. It's the range is between liking it and loving it. It's never, oh, what the hell, what's this? With TikTok, for instance, at first, TikTok was showing me videos that made me want to vomit. But within 2 weeks, now TikTok, whenever I spend any time, you know, at the bus stop or wherever, it shows me things that I really care for. You know, physics lectures by Feynman, you know, or beautiful music. For me, beautiful music, yeah? So it knows me. Now, the machine is completely stupid. It knows nothing. But this two-way infinite dialectic process means that they don't need smart ads anymore. They don't need Don Draper to come up with brilliant ways of harvesting my nostalgia because it has the power to recommend things to me that, you know, my wife would not be able to improve because this thing knows me better. And, you know, this is fascinating. I'm fascinated by that. I mean, I'm not a technophobe. I love this. You know, when it comes up and, you know, shows me a video of Pink Floyd, which I had not known of its existence, and I love it. I think, thank you. Thank you, Cloud Capital, for this, right? But this is the amazing power that it has. This infinite regress in philosophical terms. Which is, you know, pure dialectics between machine and you. The terrible aspect of it is that this is owned by not the 0.1%, but the 0.00001%, right? Who have exorbitant power when they can give good recommendations to impressionable people like all of us.
Yeah, they're always recommending Italian food, poker, and golf to me, so they kind of figured me out. So,
you are listening to the Silky Smooth Sounds of the Green and Red podcast. Please check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. If you're watching this on YouTube, please hit that subscribe button. And if you're listening to us on your favorite audio platform, please give us a rate and review. It helps us with the algorithms. And if you really like what you're hearing, please go to our Patreon, patreon.com/greenredpodcast, and become a patron or make a one-time donation by going to our website at greenandredpodcast.org and hitting that support button.
Amazon, you know, really took off during the pandemic. And I have a friend who's a postman who was delivering 250, 300 packages a day. You've had this massive expansion of their sales. And at some point, I mean, I bought stuff on Amazon. I bought I bought grills and elliptical and golf clubs and things like that. Somebody had to make that. That had to be manufactured. And if you look at Amazon, which I would assume that their profit comes more from their sales than anything else. And I realized they get this 40% rent out of it. But at the same time, isn't it heavily dependent on manufacturing, on goods, on actual goods that are being produced and made?
Absolutely. Just like in feudal times, you know, the lord relied entirely on the work of the peasants and of the vessels. Sure. And of the ironsmiths that produced all the ironworks that you can find in the castles and the great cathedrals. But the power was in the hands of the lord who owned the land, and now it is in the hands of the cloud, at least who owned the cloud capital, to extract the value that everybody else is producing. Entirely. I mean, it is a super extractive system, sure, which needs a feudal sector to produce the food, usually, you know, with toxic and ecocidal methods, but it still needs to produce the food, and it needs a capitalist sector to produce the industrial products. But the cloudalists have taken control.
So, like, Ford Motor Company is the same as a peasant in the feudal system, or kind of a similar relationship?
Yes, Ford Motor Company is on the way out because Tesla is taking over, or Tesla-like companies like BYD. But you see, the difference is this. What's the difference between Tesla and Ford? It's not just that Ford doesn't make that many electric cars, makes some electric cars, but at some point they will all be electric. They keep kicking and screaming, but they will go electric because that's the way things will go. In the same way that, you know, the mighty German car industry has had to go full out to produce electric vehicles now. So let's compare, let's say Ford is not a very good example because they're very backwards.
Yeah, I just pulled that out.
But Volkswagen is a good example because Volkswagen is already producing, you know, 1 million electric vehicles a year. It's huge production. Huh? So compare Volkswagen and Tesla or BYD, the Chinese version. Build your dreams, BYD, where Warren Buffett invested money very smartly years ago. What is the difference? Because now you have Volkswagen electric cars and you have Tesla electric cars. The difference is cloud capital. Elon Musk first created the cloud capital that will serve his cars. And only after that, he started building cars. So you know that if you are driving a Tesla, Elon Musk has the capacity. I'm not saying he's going to use it. He can switch off your car. He can just press a button and, you know, Bob's car doesn't move. If you've done something he doesn't like, the same way he can chuck you out of X, formerly Twitter, he can switch off your car. And more importantly, they do it. If you buy a second-hand Tesla and you don't service it the way they want, they switch it off. Volkswagen cannot do that. They don't have the cloud capital to do it. Right? That's point number one. Point number two, and more importantly, increasingly, Tesla and BYD are going to be making most of the money, not from selling you the car or the parts that you need to have it serviced, but from the data they extract from you while you're in the car. So the Tesla knows what music you're listening to when you're driving to see your daughter or your son or your mother or your girlfriend or whoever. Huh? What time of the day it is, what kind of mood you are in, what did you purchase when you stopped at the supermarket, when you were listening to Dire Straits? All these combos, those combinations, these patterns. This data is gold. Because then this data Elon Musk sells to Amazon, to all sorts of different companies, to Walmart, right? So increasingly, it will be rents extracted from the cloud capital that runs the Tesla, not from the Tesla mechanical parts. Ford is nowhere near there. That's why I'm saying it's a thing of the past. And you know, in the end, the only thing that will keep them alive is defense contracts.
Kind of thinking about this and thinking about the sort of like all-powerful cloud capitalist sort of paradigm that we're shifting to. And we've seen, you know, social movements in the U.S. are fairly weak. We've seen a little bit of a resurgence of labor in the U.S. But is there an intervention to be staged here? Like, oh, you know, the cloud capitalists are, you know, based here in the Bay Area, many of them. And I'm wondering what is the, like, you know, we have a resurgent labor movement. We actually have a green movement, which is fairly active. And those two movements are actually building more and more of an alliance. But is there an intervention that's possible to sort of undermine this, like, kind of shift to a new feudal society?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And many people are working in that direction. I'm involved in an outfit called the Progressive International, which we inaugurated with Bernie Sanders back in late 2018. Sanders' engagement in trying to become president and then serving Joe Biden has put this a little bit into abeyance, but the rest of us are working very hard. You may have heard of a campaign that takes place every Black Friday, hashtag Make Amazon Pay. Well, that's us behind it. And we don't, you know, project the Progressive International behind. We just want to keep this an international campaign where the labor movement and the green movement are engaged internationally. So what we're trying to do is this, and Black Friday is a good starting point. We organize a worldwide strike in Amazon warehouses that begins in Vietnam with the first sunrise, and then it shifts to Bangladesh, goes to India, then goes to Germany, then goes to New Jersey, and after that it ends up in Seattle, just on, you know, where Bezos is. This has been quite successful in the last 3 years. But for me, to make it a genuine kind of collective action against cloudalists, it has to be combined with the participation of the people that I call cloud selves, all of us. the users of Amazon.com. And here is the aspect which annoys me, saddens me, and energizes me at once. Do you know who are the people who are resisting our drive to create a consumer boycott, you know, for one day on that Black Friday? Nobody visits Amazon.com. Because if we could have a reduction in the visits to Amazon.com for 20%, let's say, for one day, together with striking warehouses, that would give sleepless nights to Jeff Bezos. And it would really shift. It will push the needle. But you'll have no idea who the opponents of combining the industrial action with the consumer boycott are. It's a rhetorical question. I'll let you know. The unions. Because the unions are shit scared, excuse my scientific language, of being taken to the cleaners, being facing litigation for sabotage. Because they're allowed to go on strike, if they're allowed to go on strike, but they are not allowed to organize a consumer boycott. That we need to overcome. Because if I'm right that cloud rent comes to a very large extent from cloud serfs, unwaged laborers like you and me, every time you enter one of those apps, then we need to have a three-way alliance between the green movement that you mentioned, the labor movement that you mentioned, but also the cloud serfs.
Is there a tension now between like the old capitalists, the people who control like extractive industries, petroleum, make cars, industry, and the cloudalists? I mean, how are they? Because, you know, obviously, if you're saying capitalism is dead, then there should be some kind of an impact, right, on these people who used to control the economy, control society, Exxon and airlines and things like that.
Well, there are two kinds of traditional capitalists who don't have cloud capital. They are the fossil fuel industry, for whom it's a race to grab as much as they can in terms of subsidies and in terms of extracting value from rents from the rest of society by, you know, destroying the planet as quickly as they can before our governments clamp down on them. And they don't care about long-term investment. They are not interested in the cloud. They just want to grab as much as they can, as quickly as they can. And they are the ones who utterly soil the COP27, COP28 meetings of the United Nations and so on. They are so short-termist that what they do is very catastrophic, but it's not interesting because it's a passing phase. Which, of course, humanity may not survive. And then you've got the traditional capitalists who are increasingly divesting themselves of old-fashioned capital. So if you are Warren Buffett, right, you shift your shareholding from Ford to BYD, because that's where the client capital is. Or you buy into private equity. You buy into BlackRock, into State Street, into Vanguard, because they own everything. And it's another form of partaking in the proceeds of cloud capital.
And where does this lead to? I mean, what's the end game of this? Is it just the abandonment of... I come from Ohio, where I've seen manufacturing wiped out, people are destitute. I mean, is that kind of just more of that? Is that we're going to see this kind of abandonment of manufacturers and kind of increasingly this kind of cloud and finance and not making things, or?
Well, especially now with AI playing the role of just the destroyer of labor worlds, that is the long-term fear. But there's a more short-term or medium-term threat. You see, the way I see it from a macroeconomic point of view, when you've got 30 to 35% of GDP, of national income, being siphoned off away from profits and wages towards cloud rents. Those cloud rents are extracted. They leave the circular flow of income. So you have a massive crisis of aggregate demand. aggregative enforce, while the cloud rents amass. This is not just a great fuel for inequality, for further inequality, but it is also leading to more destabilization of the macro environment. Because what happens is this: as this money is being extracted from the secular flow of income, think of the tragedy of the Federal Reserve now in your country. On the one hand, they have to fight inflation, which means they need to reduce the quantity of money. But on the other hand, with the deflating aggregate demand, they have to keep pumping money into the economy to replace the cloud rents that are leaving the economy. So they are damned if they do, and they are damned if they don't. So I always saw through my analytical, you know, Marxist analytical approach, capitalism as a system that produced magnificent wealth, terrible depravity, and crisis out of the same production line. Now, techno-feudalism, from where I'm standing, is going to produce, you know, major enhancements of these crises. These crises are going to become far worse. And the capacity of the traditional nation state and government and central banks and, you know, federal treasuries and so on to stabilize techno-feudalism is going to prove even below par when compared to what they could do under capitalism.
You know, that actually leads to a question I've been thinking about, is that we've seen, you know, crisis in the Middle East, we're seeing crisis in Gaza, the genocide in Gaza. And my question is, how is this shift going to affect, you know, this like 21st century empire of the U.S., like where we are, you know, we give money to the Israelis, or we give money to the Saudis, we sell weapons to the Saudis, or, you know, we're also behind the Ukrainians and their war with the Russians. And how is that going to shift some of these, you know, imperial alliances or this imperial, you know, structure?
Well, it makes the role of the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned you folks about even more poignant, because the military-industrial complex remains the major Keynesian booster of the American economy. So the greater the process of depleting aggregate demand in the United States because of cloud capital's rise, the greater the need to replace it with something. And since you know politics is broken and Congress can't agree on anything, except military spending, which of course creates the demand for more wars in order to become sustainable. Because, you know, once you have a million cruise and Pershing missiles, then you have to use them up in order to replenish them. So, you know, that for me was the reason why you had the first Gulf War against Saddam Hussein, despicable bastard that he was. But nevertheless, it wasn't because he was a despicable bastard. He was in the payroll of the United States until they decided that they need to replenish their cruise and Pershing missiles. And so they had a little war there, not that little. And I very much fear that, you know, Ukraine now is a standard case in the European Union. My goodness. Last week, our incredibly wise, I'm joking, president of the European Council, a certain Mr. Charles Michel, a failed Belgian politician who became the president of the European Council, came out with a blueprint for the technological and economic growth of the EU. And it was a war union, effectively, to issue new European bonds, treasuries, European treasuries, which they never did to fund the green transition, to fund health, to fund education, never. But now they want to create a new military-industrial complex in Europe. Which of course means that then at some point, in order to make this sustainable, they will have to, like the United States, to Europe will have to create new wars all over the place. And that will be if we're lucky. Because in the meantime, the intensification of the Cold War between the United States and China is creating a clear and present danger of us all being blown up before the European Union manages to embark on its stupid path.
What do you make of the attacks recently on big tech here in the U.S.? You know, Republican senators have been holding hearings, and, you know, there's all this kind of, you know, anguishing and hand wringing. Is that just a dog and pony show, or is there some kind of legitimate tension there?
I lost for a moment.
In the U.S., there's been this attack on big tech, especially like Republican senators have been having hearings, and I mean, is that just performance? Is it performative, or is there something more going on, some real tension there?
No. There's no doubt that there are interests that are being utterly peeved by the rise of cloud capital. So if you are running a pharmaceutical company, if you run Ford Motor Company, if you are what I call a vassal capitalist who is producing electric bicycles and sells them through Amazon.com, you're really annoyed that 30-40% is withdrawn, withheld by big tech. So there is a revival of the dream of repeating what Theodore Roosevelt did with Standard Oil and Rockefeller, the antitrust. And, you know, the FTC has been doing quite a good job at trying to target that. But I just don't think they can, because Standard Oil was technically, politically, was very hard to break up. But technically, it was dead easy. You know, you just broke it up in 50 companies, one per state. And then you allow them to function cross-state. But how do you break up Facebook? You can't. The whole point about Facebook is you go in there and you find your friends worldwide. You can't have a Facebook New York and a Facebook Chicago that don't talk to one another. and also, taxation is not going to cut it. Because, firstly, you can't tax these people. Their accountants are better than yours. And they will always find ways. If you continue to tax profits but not revenues, if you wanted to introduce a cloud tax, I would be all for it. A cloud tax on the revenues, not on the profits. But of course, no political party in the U.S. Congress is going to even dare suggest that. For me, and I do say that in the book, the only solution for making cloud capital work for us, work for humanity, is to socialize it. Compare and contrast, you know, Uber with a cooperative of taxi drivers in our great cities that has a brilliant piece of, you know, cloud capital algorithm. And by the way, you know, those algorithms are not anything to write home about. You know, the Uber algorithms, I personally can amass a group of five coders and write something better in 1 month. It's what they have is economies of scale. What they have is that they have all, you know, they have encased all these drivers in there and all those users, like Twitter. Twitter is, you know, again, technologically really very basic. There are so many competitors to Twitter, like Blue Sky and so on. But the problem is that, you know, on Twitter, I have millions of followers. On Blue Sky, I have nothing. It's me and my dog, right? For that, you need political intervention to socialize the algorithm.
This is a bit off, but I just wonder what you think of cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin, things like that, because, you know, I haven't taken it all that seriously, but perhaps I should be.
Well, I used to be a coder in my much younger days. So when in October 2008, that blog post was published with the code for Bitcoin, I spent 2 months trying to understand it, and I was mightily impressed. I thought, my goodness, whoever wrote this is a genius. And I remember I was being interviewed by Wired magazine at the time about what did they think of it. And I said, it's a brilliant solution to a problem we have not discovered yet. It's not money. It shouldn't be money. It cannot be money. It shouldn't be money because it comes in fixed supply. So any currency that comes in fixed supply suffers from the same huge demerits as the gold standard, which we know very well how it ended in 1929 or 1933 when Roosevelt came in. That's one, why it shouldn't happen. It won't happen because, you know, the more it's used and the higher its dollar value, the more people who actually have it will want to hoard it and use dollars in order to transact. And therefore it cannot. So it's simply a tulip. It's simply, you know, what people believe that other people believe that other people believe that other people think is going to be worth it is worth it, which can be anything from zero to infinity. So it's a racket. But the blockchain algorithm is brilliant. And there are good ways of using it, but not to replace money.
I think we're close to the end here. So what do you, you know, what would you suggest we do about all this, you know, besides canceling our Amazon subscriptions or?
Oh, no. I haven't canceled.
I'm kind of kidding.
It's like saying I'm not going to buy a car because the car industry is capitalist. I mean, that's stupid. no, look, there is no alternative to democracy, to democratic politics, which means organize. But it's not enough to organize auto workers and nurses. You have to organize cloud serfs, and you have to organize even some vassal capitalists who can see that, you know, they are being driven to the wall. And, you know, the old traditions of the labor movement need to be maintained while inverting the cost-benefit analysis. Because, you know, whenever I think of the immense sacrifice that miners or metal workers put themselves through in order to organize a labor union in the 19th century or early 20th century, they had to suffer hunger. They had to, some of them were killed, maimed. So the personal cost was gigantic. The personal benefit was minuscule. Even if you managed to secure a 5%, 10% pay rise, the scabs got it too. The strike breakers got it too. So we need to invert the cost-benefit analysis on this. But that's, you know, it's going to be hard. But we have no alternative. The alternative to that is simply to curl into a ball and die. Because, you know, if the economic crisis that techno-feudalism is going to fuel doesn't kill us, you know, the climate catastrophe is going to kill us. So, organize.
Yeah, I think that's actually often a theme of our show is to organize. And just, I work in my day job is I work within the climate movement. And so we actually are often campaigning against Wall Street and also against these private equity firms. So I actually really appreciate what you have to say about about fighting back against those entities.
Well, thank you very much.
Yep. Folks, we've been talking with Yiannis Varoufakis, author of Techno-Feudalism, What Killed Capitalism. And we highly recommend this book. So please, we'll put a link to it in the show notes and definitely encourage everyone to go out and get it and read it. It's been really great having you on with us today. And we're very much in awe. So very happy to have had you here.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much. You are giving an opportunity to talk about the book. You know, when one writes a book, one feels very lonely, wondering if anyone ever going to be interested in this thing. So, you know, talking to you folks is a great boon. Thank you.
Yeah. Awesome. Thank you.
Thanks.